The pharmaceutical industry is one of the last to be transformed by the digital revolution, but companies like Roche and Novartis have been experimenting for a long while, and the fruits are finally ripening. Medulin CEO Ahmed Albaiti is a digital health pioneer. In this episode of the Health Biz podcast, he takes us on a trip down the memory lane of digital health, sharing pharma's successes and failures. We discuss the shock brought on by COVID-19, why software is often classified as a medical device, and he also shares his vision for an integrated and harmonized future for pharma, payer, provider, and patient. I'm your host, David Williams, president of strategy consulting firm Health Business Group. Thanks for tuning in, and remember to subscribe to Health Biz. Ahmed, welcome to the Health Biz podcast.
Oh, thank you, David. I'm glad to be here. I know it's been a long time in coming. We talk so much, it's a surprise we haven't done this before.
Exactly. Well, I'm glad you like it up front. I'll ask you at the end if you thought it was, if you're still glad to be here or not.
Indeed.
So Ahmed, tell folks your background.
So my background, engineering background in school, came to the U.S. like many immigrants for college. I was so excited, and you'll get a laugh out of this, David, because you know this town. It's called Worcester in Massachusetts.
Yeah. And, hey, Wendy, how did you pronounce it the first time you showed up? That's my question.
Worcester. Little did I know, but I was really impressed by the brochures and the photos. No internet back then, and they just made Worcester look like the best place to go to school. And it was a great place to go to school. But early '90s Worcester, central, you know, eastern central Mass area is something that it was a shock to me coming from Tanzania, where I was born and raised. But was wonderful. Great place to go to school. Like I said, I got into engineering and then moved on to healthcare, working in the hospital, and then founding my own company, Medulin. So that's been my journey.
Yeah, that's good. Well, Ahmed, I'm a believer in small sample sizes, but of the first four podcasts we've had since moving into the new format, 50% of them are with people from Tanzania. It started off as 100%, so we're actually going down now. But now it's now 2 out of 4. So what are the chances?
What are the odds? Yeah. No. Apparently, Tanzania is finding its home in the podcast map, right? So this is good.
Yeah, it's good. I'll have to look at where all the listens are coming from and see what happens. So yeah, it sounds it's a very good starting point. Now, why healthcare, and what's the career trajectory been? I know you founded your own company, but what were some of the insights that led you to think that healthcare was the place to be?
So it's really interesting. In college, I actually Worcester Polytech is where I went. They had all these extra projects that you had to do, and both of mine were in, at least two out of my four projects were in healthcare, specifically resource constrained healthcare scenarios. Right, so I did one for use in remote areas, and then it did one for use where there wasn't a lot of information for doctors to react to. Completely coincidental. And then I went to a company called Sapient, which was a Fast Five consulting firm, had a great blast there. And then the dot-com boom came through, did my share of a couple of startups. And then in that downturn, I was recruited, strangely enough, by a former colleague of mine into Partners Healthcare. So I started working at Mass General, the Brigham, and the other five hospitals in their advanced research group. And I brought on kind of the technology hat from my engineering background. That's how I got introduced to healthcare. Spent over 5 years in the hospital system pursuing personalized medicine by the bedside, working on genetics, genomics, clinical delivery, as well as a lot of clinical research work. That's what inspired me to spin out Medulin, really. And we did some work for Partners Healthcare early on. They've since rebranded. And, you know, it's now almost 16 years later. And it was a calling and really stuck with it. Went from being healthcare IT to e-health to m-health to now digital health, which I know you probably remember all the different.
I remember. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, nobody used to say digital health 10 years ago when we were working on the very similar stuff, actually. It was e-health or m-health or some other health, right? But yeah.
Sometimes you have things that have a bad reputation. They have to change the name from time to time to keep people thinking it's the same
thing. To keep people excited. I know. I mean, otherwise it starts to get tired, right?
So yeah.
But so now it's digital health and digital therapeutics and even more sophisticated vocabulary, which is great. Things evolve, and but I haven't changed my mind at all. The last 20 plus years working in healthcare have been very rewarding, so I'm sticking it out.
I remember the Sapient days. That was back in the .com boom. It was a brief time. Sapient always sounded like a snake to me.
That is unfortunate. There were a bunch of pseudo copycat names like Scient and Viant and Pliant and things like that.
Yeah.
So apparently it didn't sound too snaky for a lot of other people.
Yeah, that's good. Well, that's I think it's safe. It's safe to have that stuff on your resume. It's not like I have an Enron or something on there, which
indeed.
So, you've worked in all kind of corners of the healthcare world on the, digital M or whatever kind of health, but across sectors. So I know you'd worked, as you said, with the hospitals. I know you worked with health plans. And I know that for the last while, your focus has been in the pharmaceutical area, although a lot of that also connects with the hospitals and the health plans as well. So looking at it from the pharma standpoint, I mean, what is the track record of pharma in digital health? I understand there's been some stops and starts. And so what have you seen and, where are we today?
I would say that with biopharma and digital health, 3 to 5 years is kind of the history I'm looking at. Before that, it was just digital, digital strategy for the purposes of marketing and intelligence and so on. Now that we're getting into digital health with biopharma, we're sort of second year at Hogwarts. Think of it that way, right? The first year has gone by. The mythology has been introduced. Some rules of the game have shown up. A few mishaps in the storyline have shown up. So I wouldn't say there's been a ton of successes, but a boatload of learning, foundational building, and so on. So in second year.
Is that partly where you get like the hat and the broom?
Exactly. We've had the hat and the broom, and some of the props have been discarded, and some have been kind of, improved for second year. But people need to find their wand, right? All the biopharma companies need to figure out what really works for them. Some of them went off and did some early stage partnerships with big tech. Lots of, PR, bazazz, not a whole lot of spark coming out of those, I would say. Some actually went in and committed to doing things together, but picked kind of the wrong starting points. So, and then others have retracted and started over. So whether you're talking about the Novartis Qualcomm thing, which would be like early days of partnership, right? Maybe 10 years ago. Then we saw some Pear and Novartis as well.
Pear like the fruit, right?
Pear like the fruit. That's right. Not like pairing back. So pear like the fruit, which again, lots of maturity happening. People coming together, pulling back apart, learning what works, what doesn't work. And we're starting to see the competitive edge coming in now. And that's what drives biopharma, to be honest with you. Once the digital health world moved into the biopharma competitive scape, where they all need to think through their portfolios, make the right investments, double down on their therapeutic areas and their science, we're starting to see some real progress, I would say. So still early, but much more, let's say, resolved efforts by biopharma, whether it's a partnership or being developed or incubated in-house. I think you're starting to see lots of smarts applied to the right problems.
So Ahmed, there's these huge pharma companies out there that have a lot of money. They like to dabble in things. And I have heard some stories of tech companies, startup companies are really excited because they got a big deal from, one of these big companies, Pfizer, Novartis, Merck, and it was successful. And then they thought, okay, great, now we're going to scale it up. But it turns out that really the pharma company was just focused on like their innovation center and they never had any real intention to scale it up. Are you seeing things like that? Or is that just people I hear about just sort of with sour grapes?
No, David, unfortunately, I don't think it's just sour grapes, although I'll talk a little bit about how things are changing. I think for a good amount of biopharma companies, for the first of those 3 to 5 years, did do a lot of experimentation. It was Pfizer is actually one of those that had an innovation cafe program. I don't know if they still do, but lots of people were invited, startup companies, some pilots were commissioned. I know Bayer has done similar. And again, it's useful for startup companies to get that exposure, but they don't always get back all the other great things that come with scalability, the investment, the science, right? the evidence generation, the tie-ins back to monetization structures, the global market reach that the biopharma companies have and are expected by these startup companies when they're walking in, right? Those are the things you think about. These are large companies that have successfully delivered medicine. Why not digital medicine? But unfortunately, we did see a lot of companies getting ground down. And that is a term that I didn't make up, but some companies, especially founders and CEOs, have shared with me directly that, you know, they really felt ground down by the whole process.
So just like smushed into the pavement, just by all the, you know, like a big monster, like stomping on somebody by mistake that they weren't trying to kill.
Yeah. And there's a little bit of Jekyll and Hyde, right? There's the happy innovation people who are truly authentic, genuine. They're learning from this agile process of working with startups, right? Really getting infected by that need to drive innovation. But then there's the scalable side of the pharma side that really doesn't see, they see this as a penny business, right? Compared with the rest of the core business, they have regulatory to deal with, legal issues, patient safety, et cetera, et cetera. So you get ground down by the machine, even though the cheerleaders might be super excited, right, to keep pushing. So
who's done things well? I mean, there's a lot of different companies out there. They're not all cookie cutters. And any examples you would point to of a big or medium pharma doing a good job on digital health, e-health, m-health, whatever the term was at the moment?
Yeah, I think so. And, you know, categorically, it's those that have the patient populations that match up nicely with what digital can do. And what I mean by that is reimbursement levels are high, right? There are gaps in care that could clearly be addressed with non-pharmacological products. These patients need a lot of support. So your rare disease companies with neurology pipeline and products, right? These are companies that have global reach, have invested, taken their time, and they're doing well. You know, the likes of Takeda and Biogen, surprisingly, are quite committed to these new formats. And when they have engaged with the ecosystem of IT and startups, I think they've been fairly transparent because their portfolios are pretty narrow, right? And they're committed to those. They have been for decades. And then I think there are some larger ones that have made some pretty good investments as well that are also in sort of that transparent vein, the Novartis, Roche kind of arch rivals, right, in the digital space, have also done great things just on their own innovations, not even necessarily in partnership, but also you could see it in the language of the C-suite and the acquisition patterns, right? You can tell when you observe those who's really moving in this direction in a critical way versus who's still in the, as you call them, in the dabbling phase of understanding digital.
And I guess Roche would be one of those that's made some big moves, and to a lesser extent, Novartis have actually put in the checkbook out there.
They have. And, you know, I commend them because they're going to educate the market, right? I mean, that's what happens when some of the big guys go in. And you've seen the opposite happen with Sanofi and Verily and Onduo, right? There's been sort of a pullback.
Like Onduo and now Offduo? Is that what you're saying?
Onduo and now Offduo. I don't know if it's Offduo or if it's just Duo, right? It's sort of, okay. Hey, we can't pull this off together, so we're just going to pull back a little bit and see how you guys do. I don't know the details, but there was always a lot of brouhaha, right? When people announce a $500 million arrangement out there, you know, it's setting the stage for quite a lot of activity. I think it just sets the expectations too high. So it's the more diligent ones that haven't put out a lot of noise that are doing well, I would say, right?
So the COVID-19 pandemic has changed the whole world and certainly shaken the pharma world. What's changing in the digital health realm for pharma with COVID-19?
Well, it's interesting, David, because even in the provider space, right, as I'm sure you know, leaps and bounds for digital in terms of reimbursement at a policy level, right? Understanding how it deploys in care delivery. But there's also been the downside, right, for providers with COVID-19. No amount of digital health can deliver the same amount of care, right? And so a bunch of things were delayed and you know, a lot of providers have suffered. Pharma has a similar interesting kind of duality to it when it comes to COVID. On the clinical trial side, clearly the first thing that was impacted, right? Lots of drugs in pipeline, things couldn't be conducted. So lots of rapid innovation on that side. CROs that have been very tepid about doing anything interesting, honestly, come through, right, and really adopted things quickly and so on. But on the downside, There has been a little bit of retraction as well on the commercial side. Budgets being held back, right? People don't know whether people will be able to get to their medication. Will prescriptions fall just from pure COVID? So that uncertainty has clouded your early stage innovation in digital health with biopharma. Overall, I'd say everyone's now coming out of it and understanding that they need a new digital strategy and that they have to be better and faster and that their agility was truly tested in the early part of the year and the spring. And so new ways of working are going to be a priority for 2021 and beyond in terms of bringing together digital and traditional products at biopharma. That is now a given.
So now I want to ask you about a kind of what to me seems like an oxymoron, and not just a total moron, but what does it mean to say that software is a medical device, and what the heck does that have to do with anything?
You know, David, it's interesting that buzzword bingo is still here, right? We were just chatting about e-health and m-health. If you ask somebody, David, what is m-health? They'd be like, I don't know, it's an app.
Exactly.
It's interesting because there's a lot of formal documents. Like I'm talking about documents from research institutions that use the terms mHealth, and no matter which ones you read, they never agree, right?
Yeah.
So it's a little scary when you get into software as a medical device, and you've got things like digital therapeutics and digital diagnostics and digital biomarkers all thrown in the same bucket as software as a medical device. Lots of confusion. So what does it mean? Well, I would say that to really simplify it, it's any piece of software, and it's a piece of software. It could be part of a larger suite that is not regulated as a software as a medical device, but it's an actual component that delivers to an intended use claim that is of a clinical nature, right? That it's making a claim that it's going to deliver clinical utility, meaningful clinical utility, as part of its intended use. And it's going to have a label on it that says this thing can do X, Y, and Z, right? And that's what makes it a medical device candidate. From there, you still have to prove out what your intended claim use is and what level of result it's claiming to deliver. And that will give it a class rating in the US and Europe and Latin America and Asia are following suit on similar kind of lines of drawing what a software as a medical device is or not. At the end of the day, though, there's going to be a lot of software out there that may or may not contain software as a medical device that people use all day long and don't even know it's regulated as a medical device. So that's the thing. So we should stay strapped in for more buzzword bingo as we go, because there are digital therapeutics out there right now that are not certified as medical devices, and yet people use them for intended uses that are clearly, you know, clinical in nature, right? And they have the claims and the evidence to back it up. So it's a little bit of just, you know, being patient with how the terms settle down.
Okay, that's good. And I'll make sure if I'm supposed to pronounce it as SAMD or SOMD or whatever, that people will know what I'm talking about.
I know, I've made the same errors. You know, anything that's software as a typically has two A's, right? So it's kind of like a long, like, oh, it's almost like Finnish, SAMD, right? But
I was going to say your international background might come in handy for how to pronounce this sort of stuff. So,
yeah, but apparently with SAMD, it's more Americanized.
Got it. So, Ahmed, let's talk about the future a little bit here. And what's your vision for the future of how, let's call it, digital health is going to come about in pharma? What, you know, we've learned a number of things. We changed the nomenclature. We've got COVID not behind us yet, but, you know, kind of really embraced. What's going to happen in the future? What would you like to see?
So what we'd like to see is a better understanding, and this harkens back to a decade ago, a better understanding of what is going to be required for digital health and digital medicine to kind of earn its keep from a business structure, right? We'd love to see more transparent understanding of investment, right? That's the thing that's holding back those dabblers. Where does this fit in exactly? How will it fit in economically? How do I put it into my, just like the benefit category for digital in some cases, like mental health, has really opened up what happens with digital investment with the payers and providers. So similar will be digital health and digital medicine for biopharma. They still don't understand how will this factor into my economics as a business, right? And then from there, they can make critical decisions like we should incubate this because we have the science, or we should partner, or we should license, or we should acquire, or some hybrid of all of those. So what I'd like to see is just clearer paths differentiating between, if you're going to have a wellness app, what's the financial value for that as part of your overall structure and portfolio, right? As a pharma company, versus if I invest the extra time, the extra energy, clarify the evidence and go after, you know, higher quote unquote higher risk categories of regulated software, what does that buy me exactly? And can I make those decisions deliberately? Because that will open the gates to more innovation, more competition in software as a medical device. And it's going to really enrich the lives of patients and clinicians. I mean, it's the one thing that's going to be a huge leap forward, if you think about it, in delivering medicine by applying this level of science that has been done for decades and decades for molecules and medical devices, traditional medical devices. Just imagine what would happen when something as scalable as software finds its kind of springboard, right? And it all makes financial sense. I'm not going to talk politics about the price of drugs in the U.S. because that's really a touchy topic. But, you know, the U.S. kind of does fund a lot of R&D as a result of that, right?
Yeah.
For the rest of the world. So, and the U.S. is known to be a software giant in this case. But software is also something that can be done anywhere. And so just think about the democratization of medicine and innovation because of software. If the entrepreneurs and the pharma companies and everybody else has a clearer path to understanding the financial return on these things. So that's what I would like to see in the next 10 years in all the major global markets. And I think that's going to be great for everybody, including those startups that were ground down 3 or 4 years ago.
But Ahmed, one of the challenges to me has always been kind of the differences of development timeline and robustness for software versus a drug molecule. You know, you've got a drug in development for 5 or 10 years before it's on the market, whereas software, you might have something, you launch it, you know, over a weekend and, you know, you issue a beta version and then you're updating it, you know, all the time. And when you have one of these software as a medical device or just an app paired with a molecule in the development, I mean, how does that work? How do you establish the evidence? Do you have to lock in, you know, whatever you're doing in, you know, MS-DOS or whatever from 10 years ago?
The lock-in. Yeah. No, yeah, it's kind of bringing two, it feels like you're bringing two opposite, you know, contrasting worlds together, right? And it's oil and water. It feels like it might be oil and water between the rigor and the evidence-gated process of clinical trials and so on that's been established, right? Like it's like the founding of evidence management comes from clinical trials, right? And I think Boston was one of the earliest places a formal clinical trial was run, right? Around our own vaccines, if I'm not mistaken. Mm-hmm. So there's such a long history there. With software, the history is shorter, and the history has been about failing fast, right? Doing great things, iterating quickly, and so on. So how do you bring these two things together? And I think there are actually more commonalities than you might expect. And the level of quality of software, I think, is going up in the healthcare space, which is awesome because there's about 500,000 plus garbage apps in the health and fitness space category in Google and Apple. So we know there's volume has never been an issue. The issue has always been quality, right? And the rigor that's coming from that long history of producing scientifically based interventional medicine over to the software side is great. Software is still going to be quicker. And I think ironically, software is going to eat bio a little bit on this front in terms of ways of working. So we're going to see more agility in clinical trials, more patient centricity or user centricity, which has been a hallmark of good software for ages. So think about the marriage of the best of both worlds. And then a few areas where people just have to compromise that you can't go fast and break things when you're delivering medicine, right? It has to follow the rules. And making sure you follow the rules, again, hopefully will translate to better returns. Because the reason why drug companies stick with such long gestation periods, if you will, is because if they do actually find the right molecule and indications, it's worth it for them as a business, right?
Right.
And so it needs to show up for this kind of disciplined software side just as much. It can't be the equivalent of a direct-to-consumer, you know, Pokemon Go scenario. It has to deliver on all fronts, and I think you'll see the commitment.
Well, nothing against Pokemon.
There are lessons to be learned from Pokemon, that's for sure.
There are. Now, listen, so you talked before about, you know, when I was asking about the innovation centers within pharma, you know, clearly they can fund things initially. But when you talk about the broader business model, we have to think about the fact that we're in a third-party payment system here. So it's the user centricity for sure for the patient. It also has to work for the physician or the nurse or whatever. But there's also an important part on reimbursement and a payer, private health plans, Medicare, that have to be part of it. Are you seeing the payers factor into the equation for pharma companies in digital health yet?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think part of being in sort of the second year, third year of software with biopharma is the realization that it's not even the same people at the payers that the biopharma have to learn to work with, right? This is not necessarily going to be a formulary type process. It's not necessarily going to follow a traditional contracting model. So new dialogue around how to structure these things. Is it going to be bundled with the molecule, or is it going to stand alone? That already creates a completely different type of a business and contracting model with payers. So payers are actually already pretty educated, right? If you think about the Livongos and Omadas and others, there has been a relatively good scale story, especially with COVID, right? And payers have already gone around that carousel a few times, so they're pretty seasoned. It's odd, right? Because you think about big pharma and how they're super seasoned about certain things, but in many ways, they're sort of approaching a more advanced, sophisticated payer when it comes to digital health and digital medicine, right? Payers kind of know what they're looking for. So a lot of it is just kind of preparing for those payer conversations and bringing those payers in earlier. You know, Aetna and others have amazing programs for collaboration and research and proving out those economics. Those have already been put to work for molecules. It's time we saw a similar type incubation and commitment for digital health and digital medicine. And I think only the payers can pull that off. They're the ones who can quote unquote do the math. And we need it. So engaging them early and engaging in non-traditional. There's no reason why we can't do studies of the future with the likes of Walmart and AARP and others that have these big user-centric bases, right? And haven't really partnered with biopharma at that level, but they should. That's how we should be engaging in public health discourse and publishing studies that pharma companies can then say, yeah, this software is a medical device stuff. It allows us to scale our evidence, as well as our reach and our value proposition.
So let's talk about Medulin's role in all of this. And clearly, you're the founder and CEO. I should also mention I'm chair of the advisory board, so know a little bit about this and have an interest in it. Talk about where Medulin's playing.
So we're playing really at an integrated approach. We'd love to get pharma companies beyond that dabbling, where they have higher confidence in where digital fits in, bring that user centricity for sure, but also a sense of innovation, you know, with responsibility, right? Medulin's role is to show that this can be done quite effectively. It can be done with agility, but it can also be done responsibly. And we can meet the expectations of what biopharma would want to have as part of their planning for such product launches. But also how to learn from the software side and the providers and payers who have been at this use of digital health for far longer, right? We've got that heritage of working with payers and providers early on, helping several startups actually get past their MVP and launching with their first customer. Pharma is going through that same stage. They have the benefit of hearing it from us from all those perspectives and applied to the new rules of rigor and evidence, right? And there's not that many companies that can do that. Certainly not any many companies that have the advantage of being our size or small size, which brings that agility as well, right? And so we really think of ourselves as partners in that process and can really lay out the cross-functional nature of getting these products done, products out to market, and understanding when to scale and when to say no, right? Some of these things are not worth it.
Exactly. So I know you can't describe specific clients, but can you give an example of a kind of a prototypical engagement with a pharma company? What does it look like? Who do you work with? How do you involve outside players, you know, like the tech companies, like the payers, like outside researchers, and kind of what does it all add up to?
Yeah. Typical pharma company, I mean, we are dealing usually with a therapeutic area leadership, right? That then involves innovation folk and commercial folk who are interested in knowing where to go with digital in their particular portfolio. But inevitably, and we really enjoy this part, we get to engage with multiple parties, right? Because pharma companies have, the ones who have a really good process, a way of putting together teams that include the medical affairs, R&D folk, right? Clinical affairs and regulatory and compliance, right? So we will have representatives, David, from all these parties having a rich conversation. We typically start with what we call just immersion sessions and dialogue. So everybody's speaking the same language and not throwing out digital therapeutics in the middle of a sentence when they actually mean something completely different, right? And so we get grounded. Our key sponsors are typically commercial folk or folks in innovation that really want to move the organization forward, right? They're using us as external experts to come in and speak to this, bring a whole bunch of folks along for the journey. And then we start assigning work and homework for how all of those various roles can contribute to the success of a digital solution. So it's the role of a facilitator. And the relationship typically takes a while to kind of gel. And then we bring the outside in, who's doing what, some of the startups that we can bring to the table, or former chief medical officers who have done this, right, a couple of times and really know where they've taken wrong turns versus right turns. We bring that in as well. And it really helps kind of speed things up when it comes to getting aligned and putting the best of pharma back into that digital product, which is the science and the rigor and the vision and the commitment.
Great. So Ahmed, I know you've been super busy working as you always are, or at least that's how you display things to the advisory board.
I got to keep you guys on your toes, right?
Exactly. But I want to know, have you had a chance to read any interesting books over the past, you know, year or so?
Ah, books. Indeed. So I don't know if I told you this, David, but I moved. Family moved here during the COVID crisis back in March and April. So we lucked out and got a home that we could actually purchase and move to with a lot of socially distant movers and so on.
Good timing.
Yeah, good timing, I guess. But anyway, so all the books went into the boxes, and then it's taken 6 months for the books to come out of the boxes, and recently started unpacking the books again and picked on a book called Nudge. It's probably 10 plus years old, it's called Making Decisions Around Health and Happiness. I remember good things about it. I don't remember all of it when I first read it, but this time around, I would highly recommend it. It's such a good book for our times right now for the COVID. And it's a really interesting read on choice architecture, what influences our decisions, both as individuals, but as family units that we're spending so much more time with, but also as like communities and societies and professional networks. How do people choose to do things? And what are the biggest influencers? And really, where does happiness fit in that choice architecture? It's a great book, pretty lighthearted. I think we need a little bit more of that. But it's also interesting. And it's apropos for a lot of the things we just talked about.
Excellent. I'll make sure to give it a read. So Ahmed Albaiti, CEO and founder of Medulin, thank you very much for participating in the Health Biz podcast today.
Thanks so much, David. It was a pleasure. I enjoyed finally catching up and sharing this dialogue with you.
You've been listening to the Health Biz podcast with me, David Williams, president of Health Business Group. I conduct in-depth interviews with leaders in healthcare, business, and policy. If you like what you hear, go ahead and subscribe on your favorite service. While you're at it, go ahead and subscribe on your second and third favorite services as well. There's more good stuff to come, and you won't want to miss an episode. If your organization is seeking strategy consulting services in healthcare, check out our website, healthbusinessgroup.com.